Hello and welcome to a special regular special episode of Asteroids in Exile. I'm Martin and Niv will be joining me in a few moments, but first I want to introduce you to this episode's special guest. If you participate in a monthly ritual, that is pre-ordering comics via the previous catalog, and you look beyond the featured publisher section, you might be familiar with his name. He's the artist on Action Labs, Spencer and Locke. Written by David Pepos, colored by Jason Smith, lettered by Colin Bell, and drawn by our guest, Jorge Santiago Jr. We talk about his process, the intricacies of storytelling, future plans, as well as comics we liked or did not like. And strangely, of all people, Vin Diesel, Matt Damon, and Josh Brolin. I hope you have as much fun listening to this part of our two-part interview as we had recording it, and I bid my farewell until the end credits.
All right, okay. So one of the, maybe like a good sort of place to go next then is just to sort of to talk about what you're looking forward to, you know, what you'd like to work on and sort of more future type stuff.
Okay.
So is there anything that you're super excited about coming up, whether it's, I mean, could be anything really?
Like that I'd like to work on or like...
Yeah, let's start with what you'd like to work on. I think,
like, I want to be like. So one of my favorite comic artists is, and I'll do what I've been doing all night, and I'll answer your question with a long story about somebody else.
But like, yeah, sure.
One of my favorite comic book artists is Stuart Immonen, and part of the reason I love Stuart Immonen is because like. There's literally not a thing that about like there's nothing that he couldn't draw and make mm-hmm. a story about like it's impossible. Like I'm willing to bet he could take like a story about clowns and it would be like the most beautiful drawn and like story to like because his sense of storytelling is immaculate. And like I've had portfolio reviews from him before too, and like I always try to keep in mind like the things he told me. Mm-hmm. When I'm designing things out, so like I want to be like Stuart Immonen, where I can do anything or draw any story. But also, like what I love about him too is that he's a style chameleon. Yeah. You know, he's not like, oh, here's my like really realistic style that I draw everything in, and I have mm-hmm. no range. Like I remember reading Next Wave, and Next Wave was such like a big departure from his like. Avengers work at the time, the like Next Wave is so fresh, and like to this day it's still like it's a joy to read. And like I guess like for me, like I don't want to be tied down to any one like type of work, because like I know it's super easy for, and especially with like the way that people's attention spans are, and like that goes for me too, but like sometimes it can be easy to just sort of relegate like an artist or a writer or like a director to like, oh, it's the person who does blank. You know, like I was doing it earlier. I was like, oh, Fincher, he's the dude who makes movies that make you feel uncomfortable. Like,
yeah.
And, but like with Stuart Immonen, like he's almost like impossible to define that way because he can do anything and he does have a lot of range. So like even though like I want people to read Spencer and Locke and like the comics that I do for myself, like, Curse of the Eel and Requiem Sonata. Like I want people to like read them and love them, but like in 5 years, I want to be drawing new stuff. Like I'm already sort of thinking about like the George phase two, like story stuff that I want to work on, like my personal work. As far as like professional things, like my hope is that, cause like right now my day job is I do graphic design for a company here in Georgia. My hope is that one day, even though like I love my day job, like they're cool people and I get paid well. So like, I'm not like, mm-hmm. I can do comics and I can do it in like enough capacity that I don't feel like I'm losing time. But at the same time, I have enough money that I can start doing more conventions. But like my goal is to do comics full time. So I'm hoping that like in 5 years, I can at least have that kind of avenue going. And like, I don't know, I want to wow people. I want to do all sorts of stuff. Like I have been asked like, oh, like if you could work on like an established franchise? Like, you know, what's your dream project? Because like a lot of my, like one of my professors who was Sean Crystal at like he's currently working on like Mother Panic for DC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was always talking about like, oh, like these are the characters that like as a kid, I was reading these books. And so these are the ones that like, if I could work on it, that would be a dream come true. You know, like I feel like Chris Somney, like every book that he works on is like his dream come true. You know, he's like, oh, I'm going to work on The Rocketeer because I love it. I'm going to work on Daredevil because I love it. For me, because a lot of my comics, like at least like my conscious like comics development was when I was reading manga, since that stuff is so like character or not, excuse me, like creator specific. Like, for example, like the guy who draws Naruto, for example, like he's the only person who draws Naruto. Like that's his thing. So like for me, it's kind of hard to think about like what established franchise I could work on, which is kind of weird, especially when you consider that like that's the majority of the American comic book industry is like established franchises. Yeah. Like if I don't really have like an invested interest in like I mean like I love Spider-Man, but I don't know if I'd be a good fit drawing Spider-Man necessarily either. There's definitely like there are writers that I would love to work with. Like I guess it wouldn't matter like what we were working on, but like Rick Remender is one of my favorite writers. Like if I woke up tomorrow and Rick Remender was like, hey George, I saw your work and I really want to work with you. We're gonna do I want to pitch a comic to Archie. We're gonna do the comic about Jughead's dog, Hot Dog. We're gonna bring Hot Dog back and we're gonna make it like, we're gonna make it gritty and awesome. And like, yeah, like I would be like, yes, Mr. Remender, let's make it so.
Yeah.
But like, although like, I guess I would like to, I don't know. I think I might be a good fit like on an Archie book. Like those ones are coming out and they have more of like a realistic look to it. And it was interesting. Somebody compared my art style to Fiona Staples, like really? Specifically her Archie work. And that was very interesting to me because like I like Fiona Staples, but like I wouldn't consider her like one of my influences. So it's interesting that like that people would read it as Fiona Staples like inspired kind of thing. Like that is like sort of the fun thing about Spencer and Locke right now is that even though I shouldn't be doing it, I find myself like every time like I get linked to a review, I'm seeing what people are saying. Like I know I shouldn't do it. I shouldn't care. It's just that like, and not because like what's it called? Not because like what people like what fans are saying isn't important, but like when I was in school, you know, like my professors were always very like, look, you got to get a thick skin, like because you can't just like. You can't just sit at home and start crying if somebody doesn't like your work. It's for me right now, it's such like a new thing to have people commenting like on a, at least like in the comic book news setting. Just because whenever I sell a comic to somebody, it's always like at a convention or it's when like cool people like Martin are like, hey, I want to buy some of your books. And like, I send them to them. So getting to see like, you know, what people are saying about my book like on news sites is very different, and so I'm sort of relishing in it, but I'm also just like I'm just waiting because like I know there's going to come the point where someone links me to a thing like here's my review on Spencer and Locke, and then I go and read it and like it just says in capital letters like George should chop his hands off, like oh man.
Wonderful internet reviewers, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've looked at YouTube comments. Like, it's got there's going to be a point where someone's going to let me know that they think I suck, and it's just like, man, oh, I need to like steal my heart ahead of time because I can be kind of like I can be very emotional about stuff. I mean, I cried during Logan. It's a movie about stabbing people in the face with your like with your claws and getting to see the gooey like insides. I still cried during it.
Yeah. But
I guess like I could just like, yeah. Like I know they announced Scarlet Spider recently and I know like it's going to be Ben Reilly this time. Like when I was a kid, I always thought Ben Reilly was cooler than Spider-Man.
Yeah, right. Me too.
Yeah, I mean, like, it wasn't just the hoodie. It was because, like, he was like, oh, I'm going to build my web shooters to have cooler stuff in it, like the little little pellets that would, like, encase things into, like, a ball of webbing.
Yeah.
Or he had, like, the little daggers that would fly out that would paralyze people.
Yeah.
You know, like, he was, like, a cooler Spider-Man, because Spider-Man was just, especially during the Clone Saga, like, I remember I had a few of those books, and I read, like, ones here and there, but, like, Peter Parker was just such a pain in the butt back in those days. Like, he was just so, like, oh, am I a clone or not? I'm so sad. Whereas, like, Ben Reilly was just like, you know, I could be a clone.
But
I'm a lot. So I'm going to try to be the best dude that I can possibly be.
Yeah.
And, like, and then when he was Spider-Man for a while, like, he had, like, the much cooler costume. Like, that, mm-hmm. like, the blue and red number yeah. that eventually they gave to May Parker. I was like, man, Ben Reilly is so cool. But, like, I guess they're bringing him back now. I don't know how I feel about it, especially because, like, when he died, didn't he, like, turn into ashes and blow away in the wind? Like, how is he even back? Like, I don't understand. But
I think it has something to do with the current clone conspiracy, I think it was called.
Oh, yeah, they've he's been cloned again.
Yeah, he's a clone of a clone of a clone.
It's not the original, it's another copy.
Oh, it's another. It seems like, like, considering how much people didn't like the Clone Saga, why would they go and do, like, the Clone Saga again? Like, they're like, okay, we didn't get it last time, let's do it again. Like,
but we think we got it this time, though. That's the thing. I don't know.
It's hate.
Yeah. Instead, we'll do it. Yeah, and, like, I was looking through, like, the first couple of, like, the release pages of it, and, like, reading up, like, because, like, I'm not current. At all. I'm not even close to current. Like, I sort of gave up on Spider-Man after the Spider-Verse one.
Yeah.
Because, like, it was almost, like, incoherent at a lot of points. So I tried, like, catching up on Scarlet, like, just to see, like, what it was. And I was just very, like, man, I don't get why this exists. I loved Ben Reilly as a kid, but, like, I'm not necessarily, like, oh, man. Like, I don't know how many people are, like, really excited that, like, Ben Reilly is back. Well, not really. I mean, he was, I guess, the villain in the clone conspiracy thing.
He was, yes, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I was thinking, like, because he's the Jackal. But I was like, wait, wasn't Spider Island the Jackal too? Like, wasn't he the one? Like, yeah, he was, like, everyone was getting spider powers. I could have sworn that was the Jackal because he was, like, green for some reason.
I haven't read Spider Island.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I just got lent some issues of the Clone Conspiracy because I wanted to check them out. Mm-hmm. And I learned how out of touch I am with current Spider-Man comics because Peter Parker is running Parker Industries at this point. And he's like, yeah, he's like Iron Man 3.0.
It's, oh,
yeah, all over the place.
Like, and like, I'm all for characters growing because, like, I find that a lot of the times, and, like, Matt Fraction said this in an interview, and, like, I feel like I can say it because Matt Fraction said it, but he said that that a lot of times in comic books they're having to tell perpetual second act stories,
mm-hmm.
like, to because, like, they can't write something wholesale that's going to change forever Peter Parker. I mean, like, the last time they tried to do that was when Peter Parker was Doc Ock, and, like, that lasted, like, what, 2 years, and then now he's back. Like, I remember they had an issue, it was, like, the fifth issue, and it was like, oh, Doc Ock goes and definitely deleted, like, Peter's soul from his, like, body. Like, I remember that.
Yeah.
But now he's back again by however what. Like, Peter Parker cannot be killed. He is like a cockroach. After mm-hmm. after the apocalypse, cockroaches and Peter Parker will be all that's left.
And Jean Grey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Jean Grey.
Oh. even, like, in All New X-Men, like, I tried reading that. Yeah, I don't know. This will get into, like, pseudo-rant. Like, I'm not gonna like ruin you guys' podcast, but, like, man, I hated, like, I read, like, 15 issues of that book, and in the end, nothing happened. It was so frustrating. Like in the end, like no characters gained anything. No characters lost anything. All of the like problems that were raised in the book just sort of go away. Like nothing is ever addressed. And it's just like, next day. And then the fact that I read it across 15 $4 issues, like just even more infuriated me. I was like, how much money have I spent on this book with beautiful Stuart Eminem artwork? Like, and seeing like all of these awesome fight scenes that he was doing, but then like knowing that it didn't really amount to anything. And then having even like the characters are like insufferable. Like, I don't know. At one point, do they just like keep letting Jean Grey like out of the compound? Because it felt like every time she met somebody in that 15 issue run, she would just like straight up attack them. With no provocation, she would just be like, okay, I'm going to snoop into your mind. Okay, I've read all of your thoughts. Now I know that you are a horrible person, so I'm going to attack you. Like, wasn't there like a scene where she just like attacks the Scarlet Witch because she found out about like the No More Mutants thing?
Yes.
Yeah. She's like, you killed the mutants. It's like, well, I technically didn't. I mean, nobody died. And also they're back now. So what's the problem? And she still like attacks them. And like, that's after like this scene where they're flying around in the Blackbird doing who knows what. And then Thor like knocks them out of the sky with a hurricane, like with a tornado. And like, they come out and they're like, hey, what? Like Captain America just calmly questions them. Like, hey, were you at the scene of this bank robbery? It's like, is that how the Avengers like pull over? Like people that they need to question, they knock them out of the sky with a tornado. And then they're like, hey, were you at this place? I don't think it was you because, it just seemed like everyone in the book was really dumb. Like, the Mystique and Sabretooth and like that lady who can make illusions. Like they had staged a bunch of elaborate bank robberies that made it look like the original X-Men did it. Except that like, once they left, there was no laser bolts. There was no feathers at the scene. There was no like, there was no ice. There were people that had been ripped up and killed. But I'm not a forensics genius, but like I'm pretty sure somebody could be like, huh, these are five claws, and they looked like they were on fingers. This wasn't the work of a dude with switchblades in his arms. And like the Avengers are like, we better investigate. I know, let's knock their plane out of the air and then ask them questions stupidly and then let them like attack the most dangerous person in the world, the witch who can barely control her powers half the time. Yeah, this is good. And then in the end, like they get absolved of their crime, like, or of this supposed crime. But like, just because like, oh, look, we caught him here. We found them. There's not like a, oh, we're sorry we accused you, or like a, oh, okay, well, maybe this will make people think better of mutants. It's like, no, it just goes on.
Yeah, you're not doing much for mutant relations right there.
Yeah, and like, especially like, because Mystique's plan was so dumb anyway. I know, I'm gonna steal enough money to buy an island. Like, like, especially like, because like she pretends to be Pepper Potts, like, and then she like, I guess she presumably steals a lot of money from Iron Man. Like, why would you do that? And then go and buy like Madripoor of all things. Like, it's not a cool island. Like, I mean, like, I guess like, oh, there's a lot of crime on it. Like, it's like an investment. It's like, but
no one will know. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why wouldn't you just take that money and just like move to like anywhere, not Madripoor, and then just be like, all right, well, you know what? We live in this giant mansion. We order pizza, so nobody comes and sees us. And no, like, we're cool.
Yeah.
Like, it's always just like, oh, we gotta do crime so we can keep on doing crime. It's like, that's not how criminals work. Any person who does a crime, like, unless they're like sociopathic, like they do it because they enjoy it, like for the thrill, they probably have an end game. And if the end game is like, oh, cool, I'm gonna buy this like evil island filled with more evil people, it's like, yeah, they're gonna listen to you.
Yeah, I mean, even James Bond villains have more coherent plans.
Yeah, but at least like with a James Bond movie, you pay like your $10 and you watch it once and you're like, okay, that was it. But like with all new X-Men, like I was paying like $4 like sometimes twice a month in order to read this book. That like, it was just like,
And I guess, I mean, to your point, at least with a James Bond movie, you get an end to the story, you know, whereas.
There's some there's some type of resolution as opposed to just like in this one, it's just like, oh, and then the next day, Cyclops and I was about to call him Beast Boy, but like an Iceman, like they go to like a Ren Fair or something and they meet some girls, like, oh boy, this is so good. So good. Like, I don't know. It just felt like there wasn't a whole lot like behind that. Because I mean, I understand the premise, like, oh, what would you do if you met like your younger version and they were just so disappointed in you? Like that, like, that's a cool idea. Like, and the, like, I think like the first like couple of issues of that where that was like the premise was still really cool. But then like Scott meets his like his younger version and he instantly feels all the stuff that he's supposed to feel and then immediately doesn't care.
Yeah.
He's like, who would do this? Who would put this younger version of me? Are they trying to make me think that like of all the bad stuff I've done? I guess so. Okay. Yeah. Like, I'm still going to keep doing bad stuff. Like, there's no, like, retribution for me as a character, at least not at this point. I'm also still wearing this goofy, like, what even is that hat, that thing that he's wearing? Like, with the X across the face? Like
the X visor. I don't even know how that works visually. Like, how does he see out of that thing?
Yeah, like, but how does it work? Because, like, the thing, too, is, like, when they draw it, they show that, like, the parts of the mask, like, are, like, it's, because I guess like the way his like old visor worked is like it's not like a, I guess like he would press a button in his glove or on the side of the visor and the lens would like slide up like a camera aperture and it would let him blast stuff. But like how does that work with like the X shaped like hunk of glass on his face?
Yeah,
because he's not like you're not seeing the X like slide up his forehead in order for him to blast things, because if he did, that would be hilarious. And then I would keep reading the book.
You'd have X-shaped blasts everywhere. Yeah.
And that too, like he just shoots regular blasts. He doesn't shoot like it's not like there's like X-shaped blasts in the walls, which would be kind of cool. Like, I mean like he was already throwing around like X gang signs and stuff. Like there's that scene where he breaks that one dude out of jail for for the crime of helping someone. He was like, oh, this girl was dead and now she's not anymore. And they're like, we're taking you to custody. It's like, what? Why would you do that? I've done nothing. It's like, well, because the plot demands it. And then like Cyclops bursts in and he's shooting lasers. It's like, these are cops. Like, I know that they're detaining someone against their will, but like, it's not like they were beating him up. It's not like they were doing anything wrong. I mean, aside from just that. And like the cops are allowed to detain you for up to 24 hours without charging you, and then they have to let you go or else you can sue them. So at least you have that. But then Cyclops bursts in blasting everything, and then he flashes this like ridiculous like X gang sign at the camera. He's like watch, anyone who kidnaps a mutant will have to answer to me. Thug life. Like, it's just
it's
especially because like more so than ever before, the X-Men just seem like, why do people hate the X-Men? Or like, why do people hate mutants? People love the Thing. The Thing can walk down the street and like fart and do whatever, and people are like, oh, look, it's the Thing. Yeah, he got his powers from cosmic radiation. Here's a dude who was born with wings. Let's throw rocks at him.
Yeah. Named Angel.
It makes zero sense, especially when like, even as a kid, like, I never understood, like, why people hated the mutants. And even if you hated them, like, why would you throw rocks at them? Like, this dude has the power to turn, like, normal playing cards into bombs. This dude has knives that slide in and out of his hands. This dude, or, like, this lady over here can control the weather. Why would you make them mad? I get because you're scared, but you know what? Like, if I saw a bear, I wouldn't start throwing rocks at it. Like, get out of my... Get out of my city, you dirty bear. Because guess what? The bear is going to attack me, especially if you're like afraid of it. Like, you know, people are thinking like, oh, the mutants are a threat. It's like, well, then why are you throwing rocks at them? I understand, like, they were sort of like an allegory for like racism, but at the same time, like, it doesn't really fit when, like, I don't know, people think Spider-Man's pretty cool. Like, you don't see, like, I mean, aside from like J. Jonah Jameson, like, everyone's pretty cool with Spider-Man. Like, nobody questions like Spider-Man a mutant. Well, if he is, then I have to hate him now because the plot demands it.
Yeah, I think that was a storyline at one point in the Spider-Man comics.
Yeah, I think they talked about that in the Ultimate Spider-Man comics.
Yeah, even in the Ultimates, but yeah.
Yeah, because like they weren't sure if he was a clone or not. Like, I guess I will be fair, and I will say that, like, I think Ultimate Spider-Man is like a really strong piece of work, especially where it went to, like, with Miles Morales. Like,
yes,
I think Miles, like, as much as I was like sort of being like, man, I don't like all new X-Men because it's written by Brian Michael Bendis. Like, I do think that his work on the Miles Morales Spider-Man stuff, I do think that is like that's great stuff.
Yep. Yeah, the Miles Morales, the origin story and the way that all came together is great.
Yeah. Okay. Like, so there you go. That's a comic that I would like to work on, is the Miles Morales, because, like, especially being someone who is like of mixed heritage, like sort of like. Mm-hmm. Miles, like, it's not like Miles is more like cleanly split. He's like half Hispanic, half black. Me, I'm like, I'm half Hispanic, and then like my mom is from Louisiana, so it's very like unclear on like what genetic makeup is. But like, I remember reading what's it called, Ultimate Spider-Man with Miles Morales, and like, even though like Bendis has like his like decompressed style of storytelling, like, when it's centered around like a family, the way that story was, like, I felt I was like, this is good. This is a way to tell the story and have it matter and tell it slowly, because, like, you know, this is a kid growing up, and this is his family, and he doesn't want them to hate him. He wants them to be proud of him, and he got bitten by a spider boy. Mm-hmm. Like, that's good stuff. Like, I don't know. I just didn't care for all new X-Men just because it felt like. It felt really sort, I don't know, it was like eating a pixie stick. It's like, oh, okay, is that it? Yeah.
Like, the premise, like you said, was a really good setup. Like, I like the idea of bringing the original five back to confront what they are now. But what they did with it was, it just kind of got really weird and didn't really do what it needed to do, I think, in the story. So
yeah, but then the X-Men have this really... this really strange situation as a franchise, because the leitmotif, the motto under which it was published was don't give 20th Century Fox any ideas for future movies. So
and that's that whole layer as well, right?
Yeah,
yeah. All the internal politics around the
internal
X-Men
politics. Thank you.
Whether or not Marvel's trying to stifle the brand while Fox owns the movie rights.
Yeah, but they get.
I'm sorry.
No, they get points for establishing an illusion of progress and good ideas, and then letting the boat sink.
Yeah, and it's such a shame too, because, like, I mean, it wasn't the whole reason that, like, Fox got the rights is because Marvel was going bankrupt.
Yeah.
So they sold it's like super cheap. It's like, I understand, like, Fox technically saved you guys. Like, you know, why are you being like, oh, thank you, person who came from the, like, from this, like, neighboring town and saved our village. We're now going to feed you, like, we're going to give you, like, poisoned yams from our field for you to eat. And, like, I mean.
We're going to dump all our raw sewage into the river before it goes downstream to you, you know.
Yeah, it's like, it's such like a weird, like, bite the hand that fed you, or, like, kind of, like, situation. And, like, I understand it's like it's competition, but, like, I don't know. At the same time, to stifle like a whole arm of your create of like your storytelling hydra. Well, I guess I should have said like neck of your storytelling hydra. Like, it seems like such a poor business model, especially because now, like, I guess they're trying to. I don't know if they're trying to be more proactive about making like mutant stuff again. Because, I mean, like, especially, like, during that time when they were being, like, really stifling, like, I mean, that's when I came back into American comics, and that's when I was reading, like, the Rick Remender, like, Uncanny X-Force run. And, like, that was...
That was great comics.
Yeah, like it, like in terms of everything, like the writing, the coloring, the drawing, like it was like that was the book that I was like, oh man, like that brought me back in a hard way back to American comics after being away for like a long time. Because I remember I was hanging out with a friend and he was like, oh, we're gonna go to the comic shop so I can pick some stuff up. And I was like, okay, I'm leaving for Georgia in a few months. I should read and see, like, I need to catch up and see like what American comics are doing. And so I bought the first three issues of Uncanny X-Force in like one book. And I picked it up because I liked the art in it. Cause it was like, ooh, I was like, ooh, this is so realistic. Okay, cool. I'll take this. And then like, I spent like the next couple of like weeks just being like, again, like I'd been dragged into like a weird like addiction. I was like, I need to get the fourth issue, but nobody has it. And I'm not paying $100 to read it. So I having to wait for like the first like hardcover to come out. And then I read it. And that ending of the first arc, like it did exactly what I didn't think it was gonna do. And that's why I love Rick Remender. That dude, he knows how to like subvert expectations and he yeah. knows how to do something that will make you like go, okay, all right, I guess this is how the story goes. And he turned Deadpool into like the emotional center
yes.
of the comic. Like I thought that would like that's my favorite part because I always thought Deadpool was a joke. But like after reading that was like the first time I ever read like a comic where Deadpool he cracked jokes, but there was like a reason for it, and he was a character who had like some real heart to it, especially like at the end of the comic where he's talking.
I just wanted to mention that, yeah. Young Apocalypse.
Yeah. Evan, yeah, and he tells him, he's like, oh, like, you know, you're my hero, Deadpool. And he's just like, dude, no one's ever called me. I was like, oh, again, like, and also like, yeah, I love Evan. Like kid Apocalypse is like, he's, or I guess he's Genesis. Yeah, I don't know what they've done with him since then, because it's been a while since I read any X-Men books, but like I really loved his, because it's another, like, he's another character who's conflicted. Like I have this burning desire to be evil, but I don't want to do that because yeah. I was raised to be like pseudo Superman. Like I was like, oh, this is such like a cool like dichotomy of this character, like this dilemma of he's literally nature versus nurture, which is like yeah. a lot of like what Apocalypse was about. I was like, oh, this is so cool. I don't know if they ever like or like what they've done with him since then, but. Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to work on a Genesis book too, just because like I bet he'd be really fun to draw. I'm gonna try drawing him right now.
Yeah, I think he would fit your style, and that's something I wanted to mention earlier because you said something about different styles, and I think you're already I don't want to say stretching out, but you're showing a lot of your passion and your talent, because you have Rare Drops, which is more on the funny manga side of things, but still has heart to it, and Requiem Sonata, which is this really serious, rather serious mm-hmm. thing, and Curse of the Eel, which is an occult high school story. And you're working on Spencer and Locke, which is basically what would happen if Frank Miller would have come up with Calvin and Hobbes, and the range to surf all those genres is fantastic, and it really shows that you're all in on everything you do.
Oh, thank you. I guess like the reason I came up with Rare Drops was because. At the time, I was only working on Curse of the Eel and Requiem Sonata, because like those were the books that were helping me like learn how to draw comics for myself again after school.
Yeah.
And Spencer and Locke hadn't been green lit yet, so I wasn't working on it. But I found myself like I was getting too depressed because I was writing this horror comic. I mean, it's not a sad comic necessarily, but it's a comic like Curse of the Eel, for people who don't know, is a I've got it on Tapastic and on Tumblr and Smack Jeeves if you like it. But it's a comic about this goth girl who is bullied at school. And one day when she's like hiding from her tormentors, she like goes into this abandoned house thinking that they won't go in there. And she ends up accidentally summoning this Cthulhu like eel creature. But instead of it being like Cthulhu, where he would like devour the souls of man and drive people mad with a glance, he's this like soft-spoken, like well-mannered. Like, have you guys ever seen the IT Crowd?
Yeah.
When in my mind, the way that Richmond talks in the IT Crowd, it's like, I've dropped my Milky Lens. God to help me find it. Like that's how the eel talks in my mind. Like it's Noel Fielding, but with a weird voice. And so between working on that and then Requiem Sonata, which is about a detective trying to solve the death of a close friend of hers who was a musician. Like I was finding myself because in order to draw something, I have to drop into it. Like I can't just sort of like passively draw anything. Like I need to, if I'm going to, especially like if I need to convey that a character is sad, like I need to put myself in their shoes. And like, that's a very, like, it's easy for me to do, but it's also can be kind of emotionally taxing.
Yeah.
And so like, I found myself just being depressed a lot of the time. And I was like, oh, it's because all I'm doing is drawing sad stories. I'm drawing stories about bullying and like somebody or like, and then a, like this murder mystery where, or like a, like where this person died and it's like, oh, it's questionable. Like how the quality of their life was before they died. Like I need to find something fun to draw. So I made rare drops. Cause I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'll make, and plus I was looking at like when I do conventions, like my table was just like, oh, here's this book. It's scary. Here's this book. It's depressing. Like there was no fun on my table. Like unless you like you're the Fincher crowd, like you like being sad, but
you didn't want that to be your thing, right?
Yeah, no. Like I want to, because like and my professors were always telling me like, oh, George, you're so funny. How come your comics don't have any humor in it? And I think it's just because like I gravitate towards drama more because like I like it. I think it's like it to do like a joke in a comic is a lot of it is like it's based on how I draw it. Like it's very like visual based and timing based. Whereas like with a mystery or with like a horror thing, like it's like playing a sonata versus like playing a song. Like a song is like 2 minutes. You can get it done and over with. But like if like I need to have like an orchestra going and I'm like, okay, and here's where I'll have like the like it's like with Curse of the Eel, it's like, okay, I'll establish the villain in the first issue, but I won't show who his face is. And I'll be like leading into like right now in Curse of the Eel, I'm doing the story of how Connie, who is the goth girl who's bullied, and her bully first met and why they hate each other. And so it's like I'm getting to play around with some of like the things that I've been laying in since like the very beginning of the comic, like some of the dialogue that happens where it's like where Rachel said something where she was like, oh, like you're like, you don't even remember, but this like the reason we hate each other is because you started it. And Connie has no idea. She doesn't remember this at all. So like it's like I'm finally getting to go and sort of tell their story like from like this like perspective of, and that's the cool thing too about putting Curse of the Eel online is that like it's really popular on Tapastic. It's got like over 2,000 readers, oh, nice. Which for me, that's a lot. Like I know for on that website, like there's people who have like, oh, I've got 100,000 readers. But considering that I had no prior experience with Tapastic before, I went on there and my first comic has that, even that many, like after a year, like I'm beyond happy. And it's cool reading people's reactions to the story like as it goes on, because people like they already have their minds made up about certain characters, like the bully, for example. Like they hate her, and so my goal is to maybe show that like maybe this person, maybe there's a reason this person is this way. Like maybe this is like this isn't something that they're doing because they enjoy it, but maybe they're also in pain. And I feel like it's sort of like in a symphony. Like I was reading up on, or like I like listening to classical music, but also like studying it. But like a lot of times in symphonies, they'll establish the theme of the song very early on. And then no matter like where the song goes, they'll end up sort of roping that original theme back into it just to sort of like not let you go too far, like remind you that this is still the same piece. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to like making like movies or comics too, in a way, is that like if I was to change the art style of like in a book and not have like a contextual or it, I guess like a, in Spencer and Locke, for example, because it is like where Frank Miller meets Calvin and Hobbes. So for the flashback scenes where Locke is a child, we decided to go with having the art be in a Calvin and Hobbes-esque art style, because it felt important. Like we didn't want it to be lost on people that, like, you know, this is the source where like we were getting our inspiration from, but also we wanted those scenes to feel a little different. So like when you see those, even though like they're thematically, they're still part of the same story. Like it's there is like a commonality, like a common theme that sort of runs through the book. So every time you see those, you know exactly what's happening. And then when the scene ends, you're brought back into like the regular comic. And so getting the chance to tell a story across like multiple issues and multiple chapters, and like sort of like weaving a tapestry. And then it's one of those things like, you know, you can't really tell how well you did until the end, until you finished. And then you look and you go, oh man, I left a big old hole right there in the middle. Nuts. I'll just have to, oh man, I hope no one notices. Like there's a lot of stuff in Eel where I'm like, oh man, I hope nobody notices that I didn't think this out as well as I should have. But like, I'm hoping that when people read it, more so than like trying to figure out where my plot holes are, I hope that the people connect to the characters and that they enjoy seeing them on the page. And like, I think so far, based on the feedback, it seems to be working. If I can make people hate a character, that's good, because like I wanted them to hate the bully. Like I didn't want them to enjoy the bully at all, but that's just because like I knew I wanted to like humanize the bully later on. And maybe by the end of the book, maybe you'll cry for them, like with their progression. And I'm like, yeah, that's the ultimate test. And with Rare Drops, it's a bit different, because like Rare Drops was sort of I engineered it to be like a mental break between stories, or because like I don't work on one book like wholesale, like except for Spencer and Locke. Like once we got it green lit, I was pretty much doing it all the time. Although I did spend some, like I was doing like Wednesday through Friday was Spencer and Locke, and then weekends was Curse of the Eel. I did do that a few times. So like in the months where I was working on Spencer and Locke, I was also like quietly producing like other comics too, because I'm a psycho. But with Rare Drops, it's meant to, like, every issue is self-contained. It's not meant to be like a thing where, oh, you have to check every issue out in order to have like in order to understand what's happening. I tried to make it clear with every book, like who they are, what they're doing, what the like point of it is, and have each one be like its own like little adventure. And so with Rare Drops, I don't get the chance to play around with the like the long form storytelling as much. Like I still want to do it, but it's harder to implement it when I know that, okay, I'm working on this book very sporadically, and when one comes out, it's going to be like a short story essentially with these goofy characters each time. So it's tonally they are very different, but even like structurally it's different working on Rare Drops. But I love it. I've got an idea for like a, because for the first time I'm going to be doing like signings and stuff at a comic book shop for Free Comic Book Day.
Oh, amazing. Cool.
Yeah, like it never made sense for me to do it, because like I'm, even though like I've been doing comics for so long and I've been self-publishing them, like me having a spot at a comic book shop when like I don't have like a name, then it's like, oh well, why would they, you know, like I guess like I just never really tried, just because I was like, I'll go to Free Comic Book Day, but I'm not gonna like insist on having a space. But this time I will. I'm gonna be a Dr. No Free Comic Book Day, and like part of me went, like, I was like, oh, I'm going to come up with a short, like, 8-page Rare Drop story. And because, like, in Free Comic Book Day, like, it's sort of like, I know, like, a lot of kids go, like, Rare Drops is a story, like, it's a comic world that I want kids to enjoy. And I was thinking, oh, if I could make, like, an 8-page story, like, I could print that at home and I could take that and I could just give them out. and then have like the other books there if people want to buy them. But like, just because like I imagine that most artists, when they go to these events, like they don't have like a free comic to give away. Like they're sort of there to do like, I guess like free sketches, or they're just signed books, like which is cool. But like in terms of like making, like generating like a, like some content specifically for that day, I think like comic artists don't really get the chance to do something like that. And like, so I want to try it. Cause like to like, cause, I think comics are limitless. Like, as much as like, it does seem like they are limited in like what you can put down on paper, I think that comics are their own unique medium, like separate from movies, separate from animation, even though I've spent a lot of time comparing them. But like the things that make comics unique, I think are really special. And there's a lot of material to mine there. And so I want to spend like at least my entire like lifetime sort of exploring those depths, and then coming back and being like, hey guys, look what I found. I found this weird way to do a comic where you read it and then you twist the book around as you read it. And then the problem is like, how do you find a way to integrate that into other stuff?
Yeah.
Like the whole caverns, the trick of that book, it's kind of like, it's not really repeatable too much. But I did the other day think of a story where I could use that to my advantage again. And I was like, oh, perfect. So yeah, I forgot the question. I'm sorry.
No, I think we forgot the question. I don't know.
I did too. But yeah, comics are limitless. It's like with modern video games versus old video games, where in old video games, the cartridge told a dot matrix what to display. Nowadays you have to load textures and polygons, and the process is much more complicated than it was before, and much of the work of the consumer that the consumer has to do to fill in blanks and stuff has been delegated back to the creator, while in comic books you still have to think, and you still have to engage with the medium to fill in the blanks and then make the whole story move for oneself.
You're 100% right. Like I was watching this documentary, and like have you heard of it, Martin? It's called Monben.
I heard about it, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. I guess for those who don't know, Monben is a documentary series in Japan where and the reason I brought you up, Martin, is because I know you were reading like Master Keaton.
Yeah.
Naoki Urasawa, who was I don't know if he was the writer on it, but I know he definitely did the art for Master Keaton, and he did he wrote like 20th Century Boys,
yeah.
Monster.
Yeah. He's co-writing Master Keaton, I think, with someone else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wasn't sure because like I've seen them, and I've been meaning to get them, but I haven't read one yet, so I didn't want to like attribute it all to him. But yeah, so it's good that yeah. So he's the artist on that, but he's been doing comics for a long time, and so he decided to do a series where he finds artists like other manga artists in Japan, and then he installs like cameras and stuff in their studio, and then he films them for like a week, like their working process as they work on projects. And it's like it's really cool because like as a person who likes to draw, I love watching people draw. Like it is like sometimes like I'll put that on and like watch it on my iPad while I'm working, because like it's really cool to watch how other artists breathe life into their comics. And the reason I brought it up is there was a they were talking to and I'm gonna I hope I don't get her name wrong, but it was I think it's Akiko Higashimura. She's the artist on Princess Jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
and like in other works. And she was talking about how in one of the things that stands out like in manga that's really important is that like she can draw like a whole page and then only do one background, because like to her, once the viewer has seen it once, they can fill it in their minds into the negative space. So the only time she really needs to draw it again is when like the scene has changed, or if like, or if something in the environment has changed that is, that like is drawing focus, or if she's using it, using the background to draw like, oh, draw your eye towards this thing here. Like if somebody's peeking in through a window, then she'll like, you know, she'll draw in the window and stuff like that. Like, right. I think that, you're right. Like comics are, even though like, yeah, with video games, even though video games are way more like, they're definitely way more polished now. Like, I think like just immersion wise, it's way, it, at least for me, it's easier for me to fall into a comic book just because like there is like that creative, like the mental like hurdles that you need to go through in order to make this world make sense. Like mm-hmm. it's a little bit more engaging. Whereas like in games, like they're very, like I remember playing like Legend of Zelda and see, like, even though it was like 8-bit, like I saw things way more detailed yeah. in my mind. Like the sword slashes were like, oh, it's like, it, I was, yeah, it like, it drove my little imagination crazy. And yeah. so, and that's why like now, like when I was like, oh, I need to come up with a fun comic to draw, I'll rope it back to Rare Drops. I was like, oh, well, what did I enjoy as a kid? I love Legend of Zelda, but my favorite part about it was not playing the game. Was after playing it, I would get up, I would go outside, and I would find my own adventures, mm-hmm. like pretending I was Link, and like I had my own like sword, and yeah. I was like, yeah. And so I wanted to like sort of capture some of that magic, and then maybe like package it up for like the kids of the future. And so like I'm always happy when like a kid picks up Rare Drops, and then they like it, because it's, I've definitely heard from a few people, like they've sent me like emails like, oh, my kids love Rare Drops, and I try not to cry.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really bad about it. Like I was most recently at a South Carolina Comic Con in Greenville, and there was this girl came up to me and she was like, oh, hey, I read your book. I read Curse of the Eel online. I really love it. I want to commission you to draw one of your characters from the story. And I about cried like at the table. Wow. Like, cause like that's never happened to me. Well, no, it happened to me last year at SPX, and I cried then too. I was like sitting there just like trying to contain myself, but like I did have like a good like, like, oh, people like it, kind of.
Yeah,
yeah. And I hope that never leaves. I want to hear forever that like people are really digging stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm just like you were saying with Rare Drops as well. If you can inspire kids and the next generation to have that sense of adventure and to have that sense of, you know, being able to be moved by a story, it sounds like, you know, that's the effect that you're going for.
Yeah. Because like I want my comics to, like the stories I tell, I want them to matter. Like that's sort of like the dangerous territory I think that we get into when it comes to like the constantly telling second act stories. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, in 10 years, is anyone going to remember Parker Industries?
Yeah.
You know, like, are people going to remember that, like, for a hot minute, Doc Ock was in the body of Spider-Man, or that the yeah. original 5 X-Men were, like, whisked away into the future?
And it had no effect.
Yeah, and then nothing happened. Like, and they're yeah. still here. It's like, that's the weird part, is it's like, wait, oh, you guys are still here. Like, okay. But, yeah. you know, are people, I mean, like, there's so many people who are still so fond of like the golden age and silver age of comics. Like even like comparatively, like there was so much like the works of Jack Kirby and like the works of like these titans of the industry that sort of birthed comic books for mm-hmm. us. Like their work was not like it's just like what Martin was saying, like about video games, where like back then there was still so much space for the reader to fill in with their own imagination. And I think that's yeah. why people remember them more. Like nowadays when you go and you read a comic, like there's so much happening on that page that like sometimes like it's hard for me to read. Like I've legit, like there's a book that I wanted to read like really badly. And like, I don't want to, it was Tokyo Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, cause I was like, oh sweet. Like I love Remender and I love Murphy. Like it's time to read it. But like, there was so much stuff going on the pages that like I got ill like when I was yeah. reading it. And it's like, it's not that the book is bad like at all. It's just that like it just didn't agree with me. Whereas, like, you know, I love a book like Deadly Class more, because Deadly Class has, like, there's more room to breathe. You know, like, it, like, when there needs to be something, like, there's something a lot of the time. Like, oh, here's a color, like, to fill in the spot. Whereas, like, because, like, Murphy loves to render stuff like that, he, like, that's his thing. And, like, I can look at it divorced from its panels and stuff, like, and be like, wow, look at this amazing drawing. Look at this, like, this beautiful sci-fi background that he's drawn. But, like, when I see it in the context of a comic, like, it's too many things happening at once, and, like, it activates, like, my motion sickness. Whenever I try playing games in VR, if the game is too detailed, I get ill. Like, it's weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know if that happens to anyone else but me, but, like, that's something, like, for comics, like, I don't want to, I want it to be something where, like, yo, you know, it's, and I think that's sort of the, even, like, in manga, like, they have, like, really detailed backgrounds a lot of the time, but I think that manga knows when to, like, let the art breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that that adds to, like, part of the reason why people fall into manga so easily is just that it's very immersive, like, the way the story is told.
Yeah.
And the way they, like, they let, like, sometimes panels will just, like, have no character in it, or it'll have, like, character, but they're really small. Like, it's not this, like, insistence on, okay, I have to draw them as big as possible in every frame. Like they're, like, sometimes, like, the quietest moments in a manga are, like, the ones that hit you, like, the hardest. And I learned that more from reading, like, the titles that are, like, for older readers. I mean, like, even, like, I mean, Naruto and Dragon Ball and stuff, like, that stuff is well and good, but, like, when I started reading, like, the, like comics for, like, shoujo comics, like, the comics that are for girls, or the comics that are for women, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like, I think Not Simple was published in an anthology for alternative comics. So it's, like, their indie comics type thing. And, like, the way that they handle the art in that, like, if, like, I'll try to send some panels of it, or some pages of it, like, with like, when I send you some of my artwork.
Yeah.
Just so, like, I don't know if you want to put it up, but, like, the openness of some of the panels, or, like, there's a scene in it where this dude leaves because he's like, okay, I have to go find out what happened to my sister. I'm going to go and talk to her boyfriend. And so this writer guy that this brother is talking to, he's like, okay, you go and you find out about your sister and you come back and we'll talk. And so if this was, like, any other comic, it would be, like, the next panel would be the dude came back and then, like, they're reconvening. In this comic, there's, like, 3 to 5 pages. I can't remember, like, exactly, but of just, like, this writer guy walking around his apartment waiting. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, and it's not like, oh, it's like a bunch of, like, one panel pages. It's like there's 5 to 7 panels on a page. And, like, each one is, like, it's the guy just, like, looking at the clock, like, anxiously waiting. And, like, that's such, like, beautiful use of space, because, like, as the reader, we're waiting with him. We're trying mm-hmm. to, we want to find out what happened to this dude and this dude's sister too. And so, like, when the dude finally comes back, like, it's so emotional, and, like, the way they handle it, like, I want to bring that into my comics, like, and, like, just like to play around with the, like, experiment with, like, the space, just because I know that, like, when it comes to, like, especially with Curse of the Eel, because I print these myself, mm-hmm. and, like, I have no editor, so I do things the way I want to do them. If I want to have, like, an issue where, like, nobody, where it's just silent, I'm gonna do it, because I know that, like, I need to get that practice in, because I, like, if, like, let's say I work on something for Marvel, like, they're probably not going to let me do that whenever I want to, or, like, I mean, like, but, like, when they do it, it's amazing. Like, I remember the
offsets.
I'm sorry?
The offset issues at Marvel. You said you remember, and I thought, because Marvel had a bunch of silent issues in the late 90s.
Oh, I would have missed those. Like, yeah, that was way, that was way before I started reading comic books again. Like, I'll need to find those though, because, like, I'd like to read, like, more silent stuff like that. But one I was thinking of was it was the issue of Batman and Robin, in the, it was like in the New 52. It was just after Robin had been killed.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd been killed in like Batman Incorporated, like in a Grant Morrison book. And like, so he went from being alive in one issue of Batman and Robin to the next one, he was dead. And so what, like, in order to sort of like show like this is a big deal, like they did the whole book of Batman dealing with this, but the book is silent. And it's like, it's him raging and freaking out. Like it was such like a cool moment. And I was like, man, yeah, this is good comics. I wish I could have like that kind of control over things like all of the time. Like if I want to do like a silent issue, I want to be able to do it like, ha, here, this is when it's perfect. Like I almost have like, I have no restraint at times, which is probably a bad thing. But at the same time, like, I don't know, like David always says the reason he wanted to work with me was because my website said I create comics because I put at the top, I make comics with stupid amounts of passion, and like that stuck with him. He was like, oh, okay, so this guy's probably a good person to work with. But like I think this holds true. I want to just like the titans who created our comics industry and like the titans who are working at it now, like I want to leave comics like a richer, more like full place than when I found it. And I'm not saying that it's bad. Like what I'm saying is that like I want to be I want to make my mark on comics, and I want to I want comic, you know, because there are a lot of writers and like stuff for people like, oh, like the time when Alan Moore started like his like heyday of making comics, like, you know, there are people who are still like feeling the effects of that in their work, or people who still read those books and hold them up as like the high watermark. Like, I don't want to be this, Frank Quitely said, like, you know, you could be like a tribute act, you know, or you could, you know, and it sucks because I brought him up and then I don't remember the rest of his quote, but like, I don't want to be a tribute act. I don't want to be known as like, oh yeah, George, he's the dude who did a few issues of, I don't know, like Rocket Raccoon does Dallas or something like that. And then that was it. Like, I want to be known as like, oh, that guy, he's the one who did the comic about this like weird thing. And it made people cry like across the country. And I'm like, yes, that's what I want. I want to make people who have never read my books before cry. Like that is my goal. I want to make a book that like, cause like I have a lot of ideas for things that aren't like, action-y based. Like I have a comic that, and I have no idea where this like thought came into my head, but I just there's a story I'm gonna do like in phase two of like George doing comics, hopefully, is it's about a woman who is she's expecting, and then something awful happens, and then she loses the child, and her husband is like very distant, and so she ends up like, because she had been planning her whole life around this, or not her whole life, but like she had been planning to become a mother. Now she's just filled with like this void of time. And her husband's like, he's not coming home at like when he should be, because he's also distraught. And so she tries to like she takes up like kickboxing because she thinks like, okay, well, like I need to get my life back together. And so it's a comic about people getting over a tragedy, but finding like a sort of a new purpose in life through like that adversity. And like, I don't know where my brain was like mentally that made me think of that, but I'm really excited to do that. Cause that's another like, yes, I'm going to do this book, and I'm going to try to do it in an art style that's like a bridge between Rare Drops and my normal style.
Mm-hmm.
Like something like, when Catherine and Stuart Eminem did Moving Pictures, like something like that, but like a little bit more kinetic. And then, but I want it to be like a story where like anybody could pick this up. Cause like my greatest goal is to bring more people into comics. Cause I feel like most comics now, like they're sort of like very preaching to the choir.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the diversity we're getting in comics is great, but still like my mom's not going to read an issue of Captain America, you know, like I need to. Like my greatest plan, like I almost want to have like a billboard of this in my room. Is like, how can I get my mom to read this comic?
Yeah.
You know?
I think mock up like, a success.
Yeah. Well, because like even in movies, like, you know, people will go see a Marvel movie. They'll go see a DC movie. Like, you know, they'll go and watch these comic book movies, but they're not necessarily going to read the comics. And part of that is just because, like I heard this in a podcast, is that, like, if you're doing Kick-Ass, then you, like, then it's different. Or The Walking Dead, because people can find that. That's easy. Start at book one. But if you're like, oh, I really loved Guardians of the Galaxy, I want to buy the comic now. Well, first, like, where do you go? Okay, you go to Barnes & Noble, because, like, that's where books are. But then there's, like, 100 Guardians of the Galaxy books. Like, where do you begin? Like, yeah, and so, like, my hope is that, like, while I do want to do, like, I guess, like, the occasional, like, franchise work, like, I do want to also, like, make a bunch of books that will, like, bring more people into comics. Maybe not even, like, as a, like, bring them to the Marvel DC camp, but, like, bring them to just, like, the richness of, like, storytelling. Because, especially, like, here, like, in America, like, most people don't really see comics as, like, a serious thing. You know, I mean, like, even animation is in the same boat. Like, most of our cartoons here in America, like, there's not been a cartoon that's been serious, like, serious only, that's been produced in America. Like, you have cartoons that tackle serious issues, like, you know, like Steven Universe and, like, Adventure Time, like, things like these cartoons that, like, you know, they're very moving, and they move people, and they're exciting, and they're fun to watch. But, like, we don't have, like, the industry that, like, places like Japan, or, like, you know, where, like, oh, you can watch a cartoon at night that is something serious, that has nothing to do with robots or ninjas. You know, watch a story like
Your Name, right?
Yeah,
which is just out now. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and like, it's like we in America, like our sense of cartoons or comics and cartoons is very like, oh, well, these are for children, because it's never been like, it hasn't really ever been elevated to that. I mean, even when you bring in like the more like adult themes in comics, like, it's still, you know, if I was like, hey, mom, you should read this comic, like, this comic here is this, like, she's not gonna buy it. Because one, she can't get into it, and two, it's probably superheroes, and she's not interested. But like, if we can evolve the industry here to have more diversity, not just of like character specific diversity, but like diversity in genres.
Yeah,
and it's crazy too, because like back in the day, like, you know, like superheroes was just a genre in like a multitude of, I mean, we had romance comics, horror comics, sci-fi comics, adventure comics. Like, it's weird to think that even that back then the industry was a little more diverse.
Yeah. Today.
Yeah. And like, and Ed Brubaker talked about this. He said that like back in the day, like, you know, there would be a time when romance comics would be big.
Yeah.
And then it would fall out of fashion, and then they would switch to horror comics, and then horror comics would be big. And then like, it was like a cycle, just like sort of going through these stories. But then they reached a point with superheroes, like superheroes became the big thing. But then when superheroes like fell out of fashion for a while, they weren't like, okay, let's switch to a different genre. They said, well, how can we do superheroes different?
Yeah.
And like the famous quote is like, you know, that the definition of madness is doing the same thing and expecting different results. Yeah. When it's like, I mean, and I understand like, oh, okay, well, like, well, here we can make, we can make these characters more diverse and appeal to a wider range of people. It's like, yes, that is true. But my mom is still not going to read She-Hulk. Like if you could do, if you could put out a comic where like, maybe not stuff, because like my mom loves watching movies and stuff. Like if I could make a comic that's like the stuff that my mom likes to watch, but it's a comic, I could probably get her to read it. Like that's not outside of the realm of possibility, you know, or at the very least, like, you know, if, and especially like, as if like Hollywood right now is very, it's sort of closing in on itself too. Like there's a lot of reboots, a lot of like stuff like that. But I mean, right now comics is like a rich, like it's a good field for them to be looking into and like farming things. I mean, like what the Descender was optioned for a movie before a first issue was even like out.
Yeah.
That's good news for comics, because like the more things like that, like, I mean, Deadly Class is like, it's being, it was optioned for a TV show, you know, like there's a chance that could be a thing, you know, like as more and more like original idea comics become, I mean, The Walking Dead, for example.
Yeah.
You know, it's a perfect example of like, oh, look, this thing that has no established thing becomes this huge TV show that everyone around the world is talking about. And then Outcast. And like, if we can keep that up, and we can keep like bringing like other comics like into the fold, and then, you know, like, and have it be like, you know, a more diverse industry, like, you know, we could get it to where the point where like my mom walks into Walmart and she sees like an issue of, I don't know. I'm losing like all of my cred right now. Like Lumberjanes, for example. Like, let's say like Lumberjanes was adapted into like a movie or like a TV series. Like, if that's something that my mom likes, well, maybe Lumberjanes is not a good example because it's very like, it's meant for teenagers. But like, if my mom likes it, or I guess we'll use a teenager. My sister walks
in,
she's seen Lumberjanes, and then she sees the comic in Walmart, she'll pick it up and see if she likes it. If she, you know, if she's not going to like it, then she won't read it. Like, you know, you're not going to convince somebody who doesn't like Coke that they need to drink Coke.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think that there's a lot of people who've never even tried reading a comic because they don't see the point in it. But that's a person that we could get.
Yeah.
Well, there's a perception around it too, in terms of what it means to the general mainstream culture, right? So when comics took over, it sort of became this very sort of nerdy, geeky, sort of superhero-y thing, and a lot of people are just not into that. But what they don't realize, and I guess what you're trying to say, is, you know, the medium still has so much of opportunity to be able to tell stories that can resonate, and that's what we want to be trying to do, right? Is we want to get people into it who might, you know, to sort of take away from the perception that it is only for teenage boys who want to read about superheroes.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it's totally doable. And it's so weird too, like the perception of comics here in America. I mean, like, and it was so obvious that women and girls wanted to and kids too, they wanted to read comics back in the 90s. But like, there were so many barriers to entry for them, as far as like, oh, you go to these places that's like a dungeon, and you go, and these guys are like gatekeepers. They want to keep these people away from their perfect world. I mean, like, that's when in America, that's when manga really hit big over here, was because like it was like, you know, girls and women were finding comics, and kids too. They were finding comics that were made for them, that were easy to find. You could get them at Barnes and Noble. You could like read through them. There was no elitist person keeping them away. But at the same time, these were books that like were more in their demographic, and they were something that they could. Now there were comics for more people, and that's when like manga really exploded, like in that 2000s bubble. I mean, like, it's since like sort of like, I think like a lot of the people who were reading those have now moved on to, like, I know a lot of people who read manga that are now reading like superhero comics. Is like, okay, well, I'm sort of done with manga. I'll see what's new in like the Marvel DC, or like, I mean, Saga.
Saga's
a great example of like, oh, this book, like, I know more women that read Saga than men. Like, Saga at this point may as well be considered like a comic book for women, which is surprising to me because like it's so graphic. Like Saga grosses me out a lot of the time when I read it. I'm like, oh man, like, I don't know, like, but then like I know people, like, especially women, who are just like, Saga is the greatest comic ever, and I'm like, that is, like, I high five them. I'm like, that's awesome, because this is a comic that, you know, you feel invested in, and these are characters that you love and you want to read, and like, maybe you weren't into comics before, but like, this proves that, like, yeah, this is a person who will read a book. Like, and we can get more people. I know we can. We can do it. We have the technology. Yeah. We just need to. And we I think, like, and like, we don't, nothing. And like, I know, like, a lot of people get very like defensive when it comes to like change in comics. They're like, well, why do we have to make Thor a lady? It's like, all right, But I mean, like, that's a good idea. Like, let's make Thor more interesting. But at the same time, we don't have to sacrifice American or like the superhero like paradigm in favor mm-hmm. of like in favor of a more diverse comic world. Because like I heard I've heard Rick Remender and Rob Liefeld say this, is that like people who walk into a comic book shop with like they know what they're there to get. It's like, If you're buying Marvel DC comics, like, you know, if a new Image book or like a book like Spencer and Locke from Action Lab comes out, mm-hmm. like you're not like, you know, you're there for X-Men, you're there for like Superman, you know, like you're going to get those books like regardless.
Yeah.
We're almost not even competing with like a Batman or a Superman title, because like the people who buy those are like, they're very like, okay, these are the books I'm reading. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, like the people that are going to pick up Spencer and Locke are more like the people who are going to pick up like any Image book or people who like crime books. Like that's our competition. It's almost like a different playing field. And I think that like a lot of people in comics, especially in the marketing, like it just hasn't crossed their mind that that is the case. Like to them, it's just like, look, this person has money and they're either going to give it to us or they're not. So we have to do whatever we can to make sure that we get all of the money. So that's why we're going to have 18 Spider-Man books that all don't need to exist. But yeah, if you like Spider-Man and you've got $20, you're going to spend it on that. But what they're not thinking is like, you know what? These people, this girl likes Spider-Gwen. She's probably not super interested in like the Scarlet Spider. Mm-hmm. She's probably just going to pick up Spider-Gwen because that's her book. And I understand like Marvel and DC, like they compete against each other. But like I think that like a competition will thrive when there's more there's more fairness in it. And like when you have if I can get my mom into a comic book shop, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Like, well, I'm sorry. And I think it goes back to the discussion we were having before as well, in terms of like, you know, all the stories coming out of Marvel and DC tend to be these Act Two storylines. People want to read interesting stories. And even if they are a Superman fan or a Batman fan or an X-Men fan, if the stories that those titles are telling are not very good, then they're going to tune out as well, right? So they're not going to be invested. And you might find some of the more independent comics doing much more interesting things. So I think even what the big studios are doing, you know, we already had Marvel come out and say that sales are down because of diversity and stuff. Yeah. But it's more because their stories are not so good, you know? Yeah. They have these massive crossover events. They try to generate all this buzz to try to get more readers in. But at the end of the day, people are not interested because nothing ever changes. Whereas we want to see growth. We want to see stories that actually resonate. And if that's available from the independent channel, then so be it, I think.
Well, because like in the end, like it almost is like survival of the fittest. And mm-hmm. I mean, like it's super easy for them to say like, and like, I guess like, I don't know. I didn't read that article thing. Cause I was like, I don't really care. But like, they were saying, that these diverse books were not really lighting the world on fire. And it was just sort of because like, you're not really doing anything different, especially like when it comes to like, when I think about the last couple of like Marvel events that I was aware of, like mm-hmm. the last one that was actually unique was Fear Itself. Like Fear Itself was the last one where like they invented a whole bunch of new characters. There was a mm-hmm. new threat. It was a look at like the political landscape, like in America, but like through like the lens of superheroes. Like, yep. Oh, like, are we giving in to fear? Are we giving in to terrorists? Like in a sense, mm-hmm. But then since then, it's been like, oh, okay, Avengers versus X-Men.
Yeah.
And then it was like, then they did like they did Civil War 2, and then they did the like the Secret War 2. Like it just, and then like it's now is just like the Clone Saga 2. Like,
yeah,
it just feels like all of the creative juices have like been tapped already. It's like, it
feels like they're doing the recycling. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like having like a slab of meat and like a Mike Tyson grill, or not Mike Tyson, a George
Foreman.
George Foreman grill. Yeah,
I got my. You know, there should be a Mike Tyson grill. Like, you put the meat in, and then like you put the meat in, you put the lid down, and then when you pull it up, it looks like someone took a bite out of it.
The Mike Tyson grill.
But like Yeah, and like it's sort of like, oh, it drains the fat out of it. But like if you do that for too long, eventually there's nothing left to drain, and you're just like,
you're it's just a piece eating of cardboard. This. Yeah,
yeah. And like I feel like it's getting to that point now where they're like, okay, and like usually you see this like with and like I understand it, because I mean, how many of their like their writers are like, you know, they're going to Image or they're going to these other companies in order to like to tell the stories that they want to tell. Because I mean, in the end, like, you know, if you're a writer, you want to tell stories that matter. And like, sure, like, you know, these are fun, like, you know, superheroes are fun and everything. But like, you know, if you had the chance to write, you know, the story of like, of Uncanny X-Force, mm-hmm. but you could do, you know, like Low, or you could do, you know, anything, or like, what's it called? Seven to Eternity.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like that book I'm really enjoying. Like at first I didn't know what to make of it, but then like, mm-hmm. When I was listening to an interview with Rick Remender, and he was saying that, they were trying to sort of tell a story that was like the Yodorovsky comics and stories. And like the, you know, like the Mobius, like Yodorovsky, like the,
oh,
just
yeah.
like, yeah, like just sort of like these, just like, we're going to throw you into a world and we're not going to try to explain any of it, but you should like, just like, but watch this cool stuff happen, and you'll be enthralled with this world that exists. And like, at first I didn't get it. But then once I had like that context, I was like, oh, okay. Like, cause it's like I was at a Chinese food restaurant and I was wondering why it wasn't tacos, you know, like that kind of thing. But yeah. once I knew what I was looking for, I was like, oh, okay, I can get into this. So like now it's like, oh yeah, like that is exciting to me. But like with, I don't know, like I'd rather do like, if I could do creator owned comics and survive, like I think I'd rather do creator owned comics, because at least then like I can tell a story, I can tell it my way, and I don't have to worry about. Cause like, I think about this too, like I don't know the comic political landscape of like certain events, but I mean like I was like, so Batman and Robin, perfect example. They killed like they killed Robin after like I don't know how many issues of like Batman and Robin they had been doing. Like it wasn't for very long. I almost
it was like 20. I think 23 was the one where he was already dead. So I think maybe like 20 issues.
Yeah,
20 to like, 22 issues.
Yeah, like I'm trying to remember which book it was, like of like trade paperback wise, because I know the first two were them doing normal stuff, and then the third one was like the Joker, the Return of the Joker stuff, and then I think after that, they did like a few issues of a thing, and then he was dead. I don't know how it worked politically at like the DC like Batman offices, but like, you know, if you're a writer and you're like, oh, this is my book, we're writing the Batman and Robin series, and then like a year into it, somebody starts a new Batman series, Batman Incorporated, which wasn't one of the original like 52 books, and then they kill off a character that was like instrumental to your book, what are you supposed to do now? Like, I feel like the problem, like, and that was part of the reason why I stopped reading Batman and Robin, was that after that, I sort of felt like the writers didn't know, like the writer had like no idea what he was supposed to do with Robin gone. Cause like, it was this, in every issue, he was meeting a new member of the Bat family, like who was like trying to like help Batman cope, but it wasn't working. And then he was meeting with like every member of the Justice League, like, oh, this is the episode where he meets up with Frankenstein. And he's like, oh, maybe Frankenstein will teach me how to like bring a dead body back to life so I can like cope with this death. And I was like, oh man, that's really rough. But then after like four or five issues of like Batman coping and nobody being able to grieve or like to like get through to him, it became clear that like this must have like blindsided this team. Because like it was just sort of like they were running, and then all of a sudden like the ground dropped out from underneath them, and then they were like struggling to get their feet again, because like comics is a marathon, it's not like a sprint. But like when the ground, you're like okay, we got smooth sailing, like we're running, we're cool, and then all of a sudden the like earthquake, and now the like you have to navigate this like new landscape. Like how do you deal with that? Like I feel like I wonder if it was the same way with like the and I guess like to an extent, like there's no way it was just like cutting people like even the writers must have known that this stuff was going to happen. But I mean, like, imagine you were working at Marvel and you were in the X-Men office, and then in an Avengers book, all the X-Men are depowered. What are you writing about now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, and like, cause I've heard stories, like, especially like Rick Remender was talking about how when he worked on the Atom, he was saying that like they took his ideas that he wanted to do for the book, and they told him he couldn't do them. So they used his ideas in another book. And there was like, they kept trying to tell him, okay, you have to do something with this character because they're left over from the previous writer. So you need to do something with them before your story can begin. And then like, he was like trying so hard to sort of like, I guess like plug the hole in the sinking ship. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the third issue or so, he knew that they were canceled. So it was like, well, what was the point of all this? Like, I don't.
I never actually got to do my story, right?
Yeah, you know, and like Rick Remender on the Atom, the Mighty Atom, like that could be really cool. I was going to use like another. I was going to quote somebody else in a thing, but like, it feels like, yeah, it was Matt Fraction. He was saying superhero comics are almost like committee comics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, cause you like, there's so many people who they're the ones who have the say on what's going to happen. Like you know, as much as they're like, there's a writer like, oh, he's like, oh yeah, I'm going to kill Thor. There's going to be a Thor movie next year. So Thor can't be dead for long kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, and the committee is the one who gets like the final say. Cause in the end, they're the ones who probably have like the monetary say in it. And I understand that. But it's more mm-hmm. just like, I don't know. It would be really disheartening. Cause like, I do have stories like I have a story that I want to do for DC about the Justice League, but I want to build it my way. And there's mm-hmm. no way that they would ever let me do it because I would need my own Earth. Like I would need my own Earth to start things and like essentially have it be like curated by me, because like, I would like, okay, here's how Batman starts. And like, here's where Superman starts, and like, here's how they're different, and here's where they're like, they're running. Cause like I think the biggest problem, like in Batman versus Superman, is just that like,
I'm so sorry, I have to interrupt you, but I just looked at the clock and I really need to go because I have to get up in like 4 hours from now on. I'm so sorry.
Oh no, it's me. I'm sorry.
No. It's perfectly fine. It's just 3 a.m. in here, and I have to get to work.
Oh,
I have to be at work at 8.
Oh, I'm so
sorry.
No, it's cool. No, I'm man, sorry. We can talk to you all night. Clearly,
no, it's amazing. It's amazing because you could get your own Earth at DC at the moment with the Omnibus they published, with the multiversity thing. That's all possible. It's all in the ballpark again.
Yeah, DC, call me. I have ideas.
Yeah,
like, well, that's how Watchmen started out, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a riff on the Justice League. So you can always create your own universe.
Yeah, I could do it. It'll be the Georgia. It'll be great. Yeah, there'll be an issue where I get beaten to death by Josh Brolin and Vin Diesel.
That's got to be the cover art for this episode of the podcast. But yeah, George, it's been fantastic.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. It's been amazing. An absolute
pleasure. And yeah. I think, you know, we can definitely feel the stupid passion just oozing through the speakers right now. So it's been awesome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Asteroids in Exile. You'll find links to Jorge's web presences as well as further information about everything that has been mentioned in this episode at our blog at asteroidsinexile.com and the show notes for this episode. If you want to get in contact with us, you can do so via email at asteroidsinexile@gmail.com or on Twitter under the handle asteroidsin or on Instagram at asteroidsinexile. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating and or a review on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice. Take care, and you'll hear from us.